So one of the words that we use a lot is dharma or dhamma. It has a lot of different meanings, but oftentimes when we talk about it or when the word was used as dhamma, well, it was probably a little something different like that, but back in the day of the Buddha, it was a way of practicing, but really a way of living. A dhamma was a way of living. We call the Buddha's dhamma the dhamma or the dharma. And so it's the way of living that the Buddha taught. On the other side of the Buddha's dharma is the dharma of the world. So this is kind of the choice that we have every day and every moment. Are we going to follow the dharma of the world, which we could call loka dhamma? Loka is the world, the dharma of the world, the way of the world. Or are we going to follow the Buddha's way, the Buddha's path, the Buddha's dharma? And we talk a lot about the way of the world. And the best way, or a good way to think about what the way of the world is, the way the world lives, we can think about the way we live being, because we're all looking for happiness. You know, we're all looking for happiness. But we're all looking in different ways to try to find it. So it's kind of a good way to define what a dharma is. It's like, how are you looking for happiness? The way of the world, the way in which the world, most people, we could say, looks for happiness is trying to find happiness in sense pleasure. Gain, which could include money, possessions, anything that you would get, status and praise. So this is the way of the world, to look for happiness in sense pleasure, in gain, in possessions, in getting things. Now, as long as we follow the way of the world, as long as we look for happiness in sense pleasure, in gain, in money, in all these different things, as long as we follow the way of the world, we'll always suffer. But you have to see this for yourself. I can talk about it all night long, but this is what we're asked to do in making a decision to follow the Buddha's Dharma. See if that's true. What I would submit to you is if you follow the ways of the world, you will always suffer. But you have to see that for yourself. I can give you good reasons why you'll always suffer, but you still have to see that for yourself. I won't prevent me from giving you good reasons. You'll always suffer because sense pleasure is impermanent and it can never provide you a lasting happiness. And when it passes, we grasp for more. And it passes and we grasp for more. So there's suffering inherent in looking for happiness and sense pleasure. There's suffering inherent in looking for happiness in money and possessions, etc. Because you're looking for happiness in something that's reliable. You're looking for happiness in sources that need to be constantly replenished. And those sources are external to you. So you, to a large extent, don't have that much control, right? We see this all the time. You know, if you read the newspaper, if you look at the television, you know, the economy, you know, it's like it's out of your control. You know. So if you look for happiness in the ways of the world, what I would submit, what the teachings would submit, what the Buddha would submit, you'll always suffer. This is why when you read the newspaper and you look at the TV and you watch the news shows and you look at your smartphone to get all the news, this is why when we absorb the information that we're receiving through the media, is what we absorb is incredible negativity. It's all you receive is negativity right in the news, because the world is looking for happiness in things that they can't find happiness in, so they're pissed off. They're all pissed off because they're looking, you know, it's just they're ignorant. The world is ignorant. It's looking for happiness in things that can't bring happiness, so everybody's up in arms because we're not happy. You're never going to be happy. You're never going to be happy. The news has never reported positively on the ways of the world and with the way life is in the world. So this is why the news, this is why the 24-hour news cycle is imbued with negativity. Because the world looks for happiness in things that can't bring happiness, so what's reported is we're not finding happiness, nobody's finding happiness. The subtext, of course, which nobody understands, is we're not finding happiness because we're looking in places for happiness that will never bring us happiness. So what we see when we receive the message that's given over... I mean, I don't think I'm making a biased claim, or it's not a political claim. I mean, it's just the way it is. I mean, it's what you see is negativity, negativity, negativity. You see tremendous amounts of aversion, hatred, anger, cynicism, pessimism. I mean, you know, this is the cultural message. This is what we're receiving through the media. It's like you know, Dante's Inferno. I mean, it's basically a picture of hell. You know, it's a picture of hell in terms of, like, the Buddhist definition of hell. You want to go home, turn on the TV night, and see hell. Okay, that's hell. So what we learn to do as followers of the Buddhist Dharma is to try to take a different approach towards things. We try to take a different approach. And first and foremost, we don't look for happiness in things that can't bring us happiness. Or we begin to shift away from looking for happiness in sense pleasure, in gain, in money, etc., and more to look for happiness in following the Buddha's path, following the path in which we look for happiness by finding the happiness of the heart, the happiness that comes from our actions, our skillful actions, the happiness that comes from training the mind, letting go of clinging, the happiness that we find in the present moment. So we take this skillful approach in saying, well, maybe the ways of the world aren't really... the news is reporting it. I mean, you don't need me to tell you the ways of the world aren't working. You know, the news is telling you every day, but we just keep following the ways of the world, right? We look for happiness and money and, you know, in a new house and all these things. You don't need me to tell you. You don't need the Buddha to tell you. No happiness in any of that. So what we try to do is not to look for happiness in things that can't bring us happiness. Understanding that in the world, there's always going to be pleasure and pain. It's never going to be all pleasure. So if we're looking for happiness and pleasure, you're going to be disappointed at least half the time. You know, understanding that there's always gain and loss. So if you're looking for happiness and gain, you're going to be disappointed half the time at least, but actually more than that. More than that. You'll always be disappointed. So we don't look for happiness in the things of the world. We don't look for happiness in the things of the world, understanding that there's always going to be pleasure and pain, gain and loss, status and disrepute, praise and blame. We develop equanimity as practitioners through concentration. This is one of the primary reasons that we develop concentration, so that we can develop that jhana factor of equanimity, so we don't react with desire when we see the pleasures and the gains and all the wonderful things. And we don't react with aversion when we see pain and loss and the economy goes down the tubes or whatever it is. We develop this equanimity. We're not fazed by pleasure and pain, gain and loss, status and disrepute, praise and blame. We keep our spot. We maintain what we could call the right attitude vis-a-vis the world and vis-a-vis life. I'm talking about not the ways of the world, but the ways that the world in general, or we'll say life. We maintain the right attitude regarding life, regarding ourselves as sojourners in this life. We maintain the right attitude. I think a good way to kind of think about what the right attitude is in terms of what the Buddha teaches is the old story of the glass or the bottle, half full, half empty. Most people don't really know that story, the actual, some of you do. There's a couple of theology majors in here, philosophy majors, professors, etc. But most people don't know the actual story. The actual story is the mother gives the son, boy, a bottle and says, go get it filled with oil, you know, kind of olive oil, whatever they used in those days. So get it filled with oil. So the kid goes to the market and he gets it filled to the top with oil. On the way home, he falls down, half of it falls out. You know, brings it to his mother and he's bereft, he's in tears, he's absolutely disconsolate because the bottle's half empty. Okay. So mother has three sons, gives a bottle to the second son. Son goes to the market, gets it filled up to the top with oil, runs home, falls down, half of it falls out, comes back to the mother and says, and he's happy, he's joyful, goes, Mom, look, I saved half of it. There's half in here. This is fantastic. Now, neither of those is the is the right attitude or the right approach in terms of the teachings. The right approach is exemplified by the third son, who goes to the market with a bottle, gets the bottle filled up to the top, runs home, falls down, half of the oil falls out. He comes home to his mother and he says, "Look, Mom, this is really fantastic. This is tremendous that I saved half of this in here. Now the other half is empty and I need to do something about that. I need to take care of that. So I'm going to, you know, make some money and collect, you know, all my allowances over the next few weeks so I can go back to the market and buy that other half." Now that's the right approach. That's the right attitude. So as students, you know, we could talk about that in terms of the Dharma. You know, we see the suffering in the world. We don't deny the suffering. I mean, partly this talk is because we talk so much about suffering. You know? Partly why I wanted to give this talk is because, you know, we should be talking at least half the time about something other than suffering. You know? So, you know, but we, you know, obviously, just play any of the tapes I've given, you know, we see suffering as students of the Buddha. You know, we see suffering and we do what we can to alleviate it. The suffering in ourselves and the suffering we find in the world. I mean, that's what we do. We do that joyfully. We do that joyfully. We don't do it negatively. We don't do it pessimistically and cynically. We do that joyfully. If we can't do it joyfully, we can't do it in accord with the Buddha's teachings. So we look at our suffering joyfully. We look at the world's suffering joyfully because there's great joy in knowing the truth and there's great joy in doing what we need to do to end suffering. So we see suffering and we do something about it and we do it joyfully. That's part of what we do as followers of the Buddhist path. And the other part of what we do is we take joy in life. We take joy in life. We appreciate the goodness in life. We appreciate the goodness in life. We take the attitude that life is good. Life is good. It's not the message you're getting. Pick your favorite channel. I don't care if you're Republican, Democrat, whatever. It's not the message you're getting on wherever you're looking to get messages. The message, the Buddha's message, is life is good. Life is good. There's so much goodness in this human life. In this human life, we have such capacity for love. You know, the Buddha said that our capacity for love is unlimited. That love radiates in all directions. Look at the Buddha's descriptions of love and compassion. It radiates in all directions. So in this human life, we have this capacity. Every one of you has this capacity. The world, all beings have this capacity for love. You know, and whether we like it or not, it does get expressed. It does get expressed. It is expressed. You can find it everywhere. Everywhere you look, you can find it. We have this capacity for this extraordinary love, loving kindness, this capacity to express love in terms of our relationships with others and our relationship with ourselves. So we express the love that we have for ourselves. And this is how we understand the goodness in life. This is how we connect to the goodness in life. This is why life is good. I mean, it's good no matter what you do. You might as well enjoy the good and see the good and know the good. Fulfill that capacity that you have to extend yourself fully in terms of the way you relate to yourself with love. Fulfill your wish to be happy. Allow your inherent creativity, and I'm not necessarily talking about artistic creativity. I mean, the world is abundantly creative. Life is abundantly creative. I mean, really, this is what art is meant to be. Art is meant to be. I mean, you don't see it in art today. I mean, you know, but art is meant to be an expression of goodness, a representation or an understanding of the goodness in life. My good friend Emerson, one of the first in this country to begin to adopt some of the teachings of the Buddha. Emerson, who said, "The trait and test of the poet is that he builds, adds, and affirms." Doesn't sound like 7 o'clock news, does it? You know, "The trait and test of the poet is that he builds, adds, and affirms. The critic destroys. The poet says nothing but what helps somebody. Let others be distracted. He is exempt. All their pleasures are tinged with pain. All his pains are edged with pleasure." That's just what I talked about. I didn't even realize that. "The gladness he imparts, he shares. The trait and test of the poet is that he builds, adds, and affirms. The critic destroys. The poet says nothing but what helps somebody. Let others be distracted. He is exempt. All their pleasures are tinged with pain. All his pains are edged with pleasure." And when we, one of the things that the Buddha talked about was being in nature, and a big part of the reason for that is that we see the goodness in life when we go into nature. You see the goodness in life, and nature also affirms the goodness in life. Nature affirms the goodness in nature, and we're nature. You know, it's like we're not nature. I mean, we're at least as much nature as the squirrels and the bunny rabbits, right? So just nature affirms our own goodness, the goodness in life, the goodness of life. We have this capacity for love, this capacity to express our love. I mean, this is life. This is all of us. You know, this is what life is, this extraordinary capacity to love. This is what life is. All the rest of the stuff is a corruption of what life is. And then people get upset because look at how bad life is. That's not life. Life is an expression of love. When we are connected to life, when we understand life, we're in touch with our innate wisdom. So life is this innate wisdom that we have. This innate wisdom. We've been talking about that a lot, particularly on the retreat. You know, what Ajahn Chah talked about, the one who knows. You know, I mean, that's just infused into all consciousness and existence. Loving kindness, and, you know, that's another meaning for Dharma, you know, is that innate wisdom. You know, that's, you know, personified, if you will, by, you know, the one who knows. But this is the truth of the way things are. Truth is, every moment is saturated with love. Every moment is saturated with wisdom, with happiness. Or as they say in Zen, every day is a good day. Life is good. So much goodness. So much goodness. All goodness. All goodness. All life. Ourselves, the world, all the beings, human, non-human beings. So our job is to see the goodness. That's really what this talk is largely about, is to see the goodness. We need to see the suffering, just like the little boy who saw that the bottle was half full, and do something about it, but do that joyfully. As Emerson said, and I love that, I'll have to use this again, in many Dharma talks as the years go on, all his pains are edged with pleasure. Yeah? So we have to see the suffering, and we have to see the goodness. Goodness, this is our job. This is what we sign up. This is what you signed up for when you walked in that door. You didn't know you signed up, but this is what you are asked to do in following the Buddha's path. In following the ways of the world, what you're asked to do is look for happiness in things that'll never bring you happiness, and then be pissed off and upset and cynical. It's pretty stupid, right? You know, in following the Buddha's path, we're asked to see the suffering in the world and do something about it in a joyful way, and we're asked to see the goodness in things. We're asked to see the incredible goodness in the world. Incredible goodness. So this is what we have to do, and we have to be wide awake. It's one of the problems when you're engaged in looking for happiness in the ways of the world. You're lost in thought. You're lost in emotional states, mostly, always desire and aversion. Or either you're so spaced out on sense pleasure that you're in a delusional state, so you can't notice the goodness in the world. You don't notice the goodness of the world. I mean, how can you notice the goodness in the world when you're spending your whole time text messaging? I mean, you're not going to see the goodness in the world when you're going like this. That's a good metaphor for how, you know, sort of we are. You know, it's like used to be, you could see the good, you could find out about the world like only in a movie theater on the newsreel, you know. Then it was the television, and now it's like the text message, the smartphone, you know. So we're asked to see the goodness in the world, in life, and appreciate, and take joy. Now, this is the sublime attitude of joy, one of the sublime attitudes. This is how the Buddha asks that we live, with the attitude of joy. The Buddha doesn't say, go around cynical and negative and pessimistic all the time. That's the way of the world. That's the attitude of the world. That's not the attitude that we adopt, that we take, that we learn as followers of the Buddha's path. We adopt the sublime attitude of joy. So, of course, like any other skill or ability to do that, this, you know, it's a skill that has to be developed. You know, it's just not, you know, it's like, you know, there are certain practices, methodologies, and within Buddhism, too, that just say, just be joyful, be happy, you know, which is great, but, you know, we're so inculcated to the ways of the world, and the tracks in our mind are so deeply rutted with negativity and pessimism that we have to retrain the mind. Or train the mind. We have to train the mind in a different direction. So we have to develop the skill of seeing the joy in the world, seeing the joy in life, appreciating the joy in life. And of course, the way the Buddha has us begin to do that is by developing generosity, which is very countercultural and begins to make a shift from getting, the ways of the world are all about getting sense pleasure and getting things, to giving. And when we start to do that, we experience joy. Teachings are really clear about that. If you practice generosity skillful, it leads to joy. So that's the easiest way to begin to know joy. So you have to practice generosity, but then you have to see the joy that arises when you do. We talk about this a lot. This is part of the skill, because it's not enough just to practice generosity. Suzanne was the manager tonight. Narissa brought refreshments. Did somebody have the altar? Ken had the altar. Set up? Stephanie. So their job tonight is they practiced. I'm putting them all on the spot here. But their job tonight, I'm sorry to say, is that at some point between now and the time that you go to bed tonight, is you have to recognize your generosity, appreciate it, and take joy. It's not enough just to act with generosity, because, you know, we could very easily act with generosity. You can't go, why did I bring those flowers? You know, I think I brought them, you know. No. Acknowledge your generosity and take joy. Take joy. So the list is there for next week. If anybody wants to check out this joy thing, just sign up. So we develop these skillful qualities of generosity, of ethical conduct, as a way of taking good care of ourselves and cultivating joy. Now, through the practice, we've been talking about this a lot, through the practice of meditation, through the practice of mindfulness, mental training, we learn to live joyfully. We learn to know joy, and we learn to replace cynicism and negativity with joy. Because meditation is just a microcosm of life. Meditation is life. So within the microcosm, within the confines of meditation, of mindfulness practice, if you can learn to relate to that practice in a way in which you're seeing joy and appreciating joy and cultivating joy, understanding the joy in life, because meditation is just life. It's like, that's what it is. How am I going to relate to myself skillfully? We try to make it really easy. You don't have to do anything. Just close your eyes. Feel your breath. See how you relate to that. You know, but what do we usually do? You know, it's like, I can't do it. This is terrible. This is awful. It's like you're in training to be an anchor on the news, you know? Okay? So, you know, this is typically what we do, right? It's like aversion to the practice and doubt. practice sucks, this is terrible, this is awful, I can't do it, I'm bad at it, look at everybody else. So, you know, that's good when you see those things. It's like I'm teaching a beginner's class now and I'm trying to tell them, that's good when you see how much you hate the meditation. That's good when you see that you doubt yourself. They're like, look at me like I'm crazy. You know, it's like, so, you know, this is the beauty of the meditation. We quiet down enough so that we can see how much we hate everything and doubt ourselves. You know? It's like we don't put that in the brochures, but that's basically what it is, you know? So you start to see your aversion, your negativity, and you start to ask, is that useful? Is that really serving me? Can I put that to the side? Can I relate to the meditation a little differently? Can I recognize the blessings in being able to practice? Can I recognize the blessings in being here with everybody? Can I recognize the blessing of this path? And I told this story on the retreat, but yeah, a lot of you were there, but not everybody. How when I was at Wat Metta not too long ago in May, I was there for a couple of weeks, and you know, it was kind of, as always, you know, there were challenges and there were difficulties, you know, and I was like, oh, when am I going to get out of here? This is awful. This is, you know, just what I'm talking about. But I would notice that usually, I usually catch it, you know, after the second or third, this is terrible. This is awful. You know? So I would catch it, and, you know, and I would say to myself, okay, there's aversion. Can I put that to the side? What a blessing it is to be here. You know, and then there's a voice in my mind, who are you kidding? You don't believe that for a second. You know, but all right, thanks for sharing. Put that to the side. And as I said, I told the story. And I would, that went on for like the first 4 or 5 days, you know, and then sort of about after a week, it was like, oh, what a blessing it is to be here. You know, I felt that joy. I saw the joy in it. I appreciated the joy in it. But that didn't happen automatically. If I didn't do something, if I didn't intervene, my habitual way of relating to my experience would have dictated how that retreat went and what my mind was like. I had to make an intervention. I had to see, oh, this is terrible. This is what we learn to do. So within the practice, we learn to understand joy, to know joy, to see joy. It's like we don't practice to be miserable. Yeah. So the practice, it's kind of like, well, I'm really miserable doing this practice, but I'm doing it so I can be happy. I mean, that makes no sense at all, right? I mean, that's how I was sort of my first few years of practice. I really hate this. This is awful, but I know I'm doing it so I can be happy. That makes no sense at all. That only began to change when I learned to develop joyfulness in the practice. When I learned to brighten the mind before every sitting, when I learned to see my tendencies and to go into aversion to the practice or self-doubt, I learned to bring joy. I learned to cultivate joy in the practice. The practice must be joyful. The practice must be joyful. I mean, the Buddha was really clear about this. You're not going to develop unless the practice is joyful. You're not going to develop concentration unless the practice is joyful. You're not going to be happy in life unless you're joyful, unless you relate to life joyfully. You know, I think we think, you know, if I relate to, I mean, it seems that way. If I relate to life negatively, I mean, that's what we believe on some level, we'll be happy. So, you know, in life, it's the same skills. You know, it's the same skills. It's like we see the goodness in life. I mean, every day, every moment. I mean, there's so much goodness right here, right now. We could sit here and go, boy, you know, I'm too hot, I'm too cold, I hope they have good refreshments. You know, it's like you're sitting in a state of grace. Notice that. Appreciate the blessing of the goodness that's right here, right now. This is the same practice. We learn to appreciate the goodness in life. Take joy. And we begin to notice when there's darkness in life. Oh, my life, it's terrible. Oh, it's going this way. Now, a lot of the practice in general is about abandoning desire and aversion, abandoning the ways of the world. So if we continue to practice, we'll begin to change the habitual patterns in the mind, and we'll begin to live in a way in which we are considering life and seeing its joy, seeing the joy in life. I always liked what the former Supreme Court Justice Earl Warren said. He said, when I pick up the newspaper, the first thing I do is turn to the sports page. He says, it's the only place in the paper where I can read of man's accomplishments. So we have to be willing to be joyful. We have to be willing to be joyful. There's a lot of resistance because we're so identified with being miserable and negativity. And that was sort of a romantic posture to take when I was in my adolescence and early adulthood. For me, it was. It's like we have to give that up. We have to abandon that unskillful way of relating to life and learn to be joyful. One of my favorite E.E. Cummings poems will end on. I thank you, God, for this most amazing day, for the leaping greenly spirits of trees and a blue true dream of sky, and for everything which is natural, which is infinite, which is yes. I who have died am alive again today, and this is the sun's birthday. This is the birthday of life and of love and wings and of the gay, great, happening, illimitably earth. How should tasting, touching, hearing, seeing, breathing, any, lifted from the know of all nothing, human being, doubt unimaginable you? Now the eyes of my ears awake, and now the eyes of my eyes are opened. So let's just sit for a moment.